Hello, everyone. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. I'm Brett. Today's October 23rd. And before we do anything at all on this show today, I want to say hello, welcome, and thank you to all of the new people who are giving School Sucks Podcast a try. I know, listen, there's a lot of podcasts out there, a lot of really good podcasts, and I really appreciate people giving us some of their time. All I can really tell is that people have downloaded the show. Hopefully you've listened. But even that, downloading, you know, megabytes, that takes time. I hope you're finding this useful and entertaining. And if you have just a little bit of extra time, just a little bit, some things that you could do. If you're new to the show, if you've only heard the last few episodes, these are some things you've never heard me ask people to do before. Well, first of all, you can go to Facebook if you're still doing that whole Facebook thing. And you can like our page, School Sucks Podcast. You type that into the top, the search there. You will find us. Also, Twitter, relatively new thing using Twitter. School Sucks Show is our name. Looking for followers. We've got not really that many, but I think it'll grow pretty fast if I start paying more attention to it. And the other thing, YouTube. School Sucks Podcast is the name of our YouTube channel. Just had a video called The American Way reach 100,000 views, which is great. And after you've done all that, if you find that you just have a little bit more free time now and then, some things you could do. Well, if you're on Facebook and you see School Sucks Podcast post something, you could like it, you could share it. If you think people who you're friends with on Facebook would find it useful, when you are on the Twitter and you see that I tweeted something and you think it's retweetable, go ahead and retweet it, you know, to your followers. That would be super helpful. And when stuff is posted on YouTube, I do a lot of like little YouTube videos. I'm working on kind of a big one right now that's more of a long-term project. I'll watch them. I don't know, like them, comment, share, all super, super helpful things. So again, thank you so much. Did I say thank you yet? I believe I did. I also owe a lot of people a new subscriber geography trivia. That's where somebody becomes what I call a subscriber. That doesn't just mean that they subscribe to the RSS feed. But they make a commitment to give us a little bit of money every month. We ask for $6. It gets you access to some additional content, which right now, until the new website is ready, I'm emailing to people. But soon there'll be a new website. We're working through some technical challenges with that. And you'll see all kinds of stuff on there. So when people first sign up, I made a commitment that I would thank them on the show through something called New Subscriber Geography Trivia, where I say their name and then tell a fact about where they live, because PayPal provides me with that information, where they live. And, you know, everybody almost lives in a place that has an interesting story, so I'll tell it on the show. We'll learn some geography. We'll say thank you to those people. Good stuff. Now, today on the show, my guest is going to be Wes Bertrand, same guy from the last show. In fact, we recorded this all at once last Thursday. We did a Ustream-only live show. I want to thank everyone who listened, everyone who participated in the chat, asked questions, put in comments. And the first part of the show you heard, if you listened to the previous podcast, we did the Logic Saves Lives continuation of that series, talking about stolen concept fallacy. In the second part, I actually wind up discussing a book Wes is currently reviewing on his show called Breaking Free. It was written by the psychologist Nathaniel Brandon, who we've mentioned on this show plenty of times before, in the early 1970s. Now, these are Brandon's counseling sessions, mostly group counseling. And in these sessions, he used a series of questions to help bring to the surface experiences from childhood that were impactful and, in many cases, traumatic. Kind of quietly, often in the background, haunting people in their adult lives. So this is, you know, confronting that stuff, accepting it, dealing with it. It's not about assigning blame. Obviously, most of the questions are related to parenting. We in the show apply some of it to school because that's what we do on this podcast, but not about protagonists and antagonists, really about what was my reaction, what did I internalize, how did it at this very impressionable time in my life end up affecting me in the long run, and the most important question, what can I do about it? Because acceptance is certainly not synonymous with resignation. And I think that it is very important for us to continue to pursue these discussions lateral to our discussions about institutionalized schooling. I highly, highly recommend Wes's work at CompleteLiberty.com, his podcast. I'll put links to some things in the show notes. Now, this is something we've talked about on the show many, many, many times in the past. The paradigm in which we currently live today would make virtually no sense to almost anybody. And I'm talking about the political, the societal, the domination culture if it were not for 15,000 hours spent in institutionalized schooling. People run through that process. On the other end, we have adult society, and that place makes perfect sense. But the institution of school itself would make little sense, and most people, even at a very young age, probably come to understand very quickly that is an unacceptable way of treating human beings. But they would only know that if they were raised in unconditional, loving, and enlightened families, which unfortunately is very, very rare. A point that I couldn't develop fully just because of the sake of time and the flow of the conversation. The first question was something like, and I'm paraphrasing this a little bit, when you were a child, did your parents' manner of behaving and dealing with you give you the impression that you were living in a world that was rational, predictable, and intelligible, or a world that was bewildering, contradictory, and incomprehensible? Well, you know, the adult world, its institutions, practices, and often its relationships is largely dysfunctional, illogical, contradictory, and emotionally unstable. You are born into it. You're natural, healthy, most of the time. But then, slowly over the course of your very impressionable childhood, where you have very little control over your surroundings, your circumstances, you are taught to fit in to that adult world, which is already just buzzing along, right? And if you behave and do what you're told, you can be invited to be a part of it. And another thing that you'll hear us touch on in the show today is that self-reflection, self-knowledge, for most people, for the average person, something that is relatively new in the present-day world, which we inherit, is the product, the snowball of generations, centuries of a very unenlightened treatment of young people. And, of course, the unprocessed, unconfronted trauma that goes along with that for adults. Granted, most people, most parents, I think they probably try to do the best they can. At least a lot of parents try to do the best they can. They often don't understand how their behavior, their feelings, their emotions are amplified in the eyes, the perception of the child. And if the parents could, you know, through really their own self-knowledge, which means probably dealing with the things that happened to them when they were children, were able to provide a stable, rational, predictable world, the child would more often than not believe that his or her mind was a useful and practical tool. But if the world is so chaotic and confusing and inconsistent that they just can't make sense of things, I mean, when we're young, we don't know how to interpret parental or adult behavior. And I think one of the things that Brandon suggests in the book is that often children might assume that adults are totally being rational all the time. But in reality, I mean, even if we just focused in one area, like let's just take the political, we can see that the opposite is often true. But as a child, I think the default position is that, yes, adults are rational. Adults know what they're doing. Because imagine how scary it is to come to realize that a lot of the time they don't. But, you know, human beings, we're rational animals. We want to make meaning out of things. And I think whatever adults do, often kids assume that they know what they're doing or what they're doing is right. And certainly this is being reinforced in school and pretty much reinforced the, you know, whole authority paradigm throughout a person's entire life. So at a very young age, when people are very impressionable and they lack the perspective to really, really understand what's happening right in front of them day in and day out, the question might be, well, if the adults know what they're doing, but they keep reacting to me, the things I do or the things that I say, or even just treating me in all these different ways, I can't ferret out the contradictions. I mean, this obviously is not a conscious thought, but for a rational animal, that's what we're trying to do. Well, the child ultimately might say, what's wrong with me? And the result, all too often, is that people grow up not trusting their own minds. They don't believe that what they have in that head of theirs is a useful and practical tool. And oh boy, in the adult world, people are just lining up to take advantage of this problem. Because if people don't trust their own minds, people defer to authority. People probably behave because of that authority in relatively similar, predictable ways and are ultimately very easy to manage and control. So I think that it is irresponsible for me to talk about all of these schooling issues without dealing with this subject as well, because if humanity could get the parenting thing right, this wouldn't even need to be a show. Past week, I was listening to this podcast that I've really gotten into lately. It's called You Made It Weird with Pete Holmes. Pete Holmes is a comedian. You probably would know him as the voice of the E-Trade baby in those fun commercials. I think they first appeared in a Super Bowl a couple years back. Very talented, very funny, very likable guy. And he does this podcast, You Made It Weird, where he just talks with other comedians, an hour and a half. It's very loose, very conversational, very enjoyable about their lives. And one of the recurring themes on You Made It Weird is that, you know, comedy often comes from pain. One of the episodes that I was listening to really, really hit me. Pete was talking to Adam Carolla, you know, very popular comic over really, I think at this point, at least 15 years, probably a little bit longer. Did Loveline on MTV, was on The Man Show, has a very, very popular comedy podcast of his own right now, probably number one in comedy on iTunes. And I like Adam Carolla. I find him interesting because he can so smoothly, it seems, just intersperse things that I agree with 100% with other things that I just find totally outrageous. I just could not disagree with more, especially, you know, when he's talking about childhood. So I want people to understand that I'm going to play this clip. It's a long lead in today. This clip itself is about 13 minutes, but this really, really impacted me. And I think as you listen to it, and if you've known some of the things that I've talked about on the show in the past, you'll understand why. And maybe some of you will find that the same is true for you. I'm not suggesting that I agree 100% with his assessment, with his attitude. I'm not saying that this is any way prescriptive for other people, but I thought this was a very engaging and at times entertaining way to tell a very, very painful story that I could really, in many ways, relate to. I want to warn you, this clip has some very strong language. It is also, if you are learning about nonviolent communication, and you'll hear Wes mention this in the show, and our discussion is going to be right after this for about an hour, jackal language versus giraffe language. This is jackal language. Okay? So you've been warned, and that's it. Here we go. Thanks for listening. Take care.
My mom did something that was really funny that I didn't see. I didn't notice because I'm indoctrinated into this horrible cult of low self-esteem. And my wife noticed. My mother walked through my front door. She came over about 7 years ago to, like, just say hi on a Saturday and have a cup of coffee with stepdad Toe, who does not speak at all. And she came walking through the door, and she had in her hand a VHS cassette. And she said, "This is an episode of Oprah." Glad you're sitting down. "And you know who's on it? A funny, funny comedian by the name of Jon Stewart."
Oh.
And so the first thing my family does is they don't understand who I am or what I do or who I know or anything. I'll give you 3.5 good stories. So my mom says to me,
"The more I laugh, the more stories."
Yes. My mom says, "Have you heard of Jon Stewart?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm on the same fucking channel he's on. Of course I know." We have the same agent, by the way. "Of course I know." See, the first thing is this weird sort of discredit through. It's kind of a condescending thing where it's like, "Have you heard? Have you heard of George Carlin?"
Right.
Like,
right.
"What the fuck do you think I do for a living?"
Right.
You know. So we're on the same.
What are
network.
They protecting there? Do they not want to look stupid? Do they want to look inclusive? Why don't they just say, "Of course you know Jon Stewart"?
They cannot wrap their mind around the fact that anybody from their family would have any kind of success or do anything that wasn't just a complete abject failure.
Can I interject with a weird question?
Yes.
Do you get into numbers with them? Tell them money? That's I try not to, but with my dad, the only thing I can say, because he's a score guy, he's a man. He's like you. He likes sports. He likes numbers, and he likes competition. So if I go, Dad, I'm doing Conan, he'll go, and I go, it pays like blah, blah. And he's like, okay. You know what I mean? That's the only thing that works.
The only...
I mean, you have to have stories. I know what they pay for a pilot and a series and the things you've done.
I've never talked to no one in my family's ever asked me a question. Not. I mean, they've never asked me a question.
I can't relate more.
Never been a question asked. I'll tell you five quick things. One is we do the Feast of San Gennaro behind Jimmy Kimmel's theater. We're going on year number 11. It's here. My parents have lived in North Hollywood, which is 3.5 miles from here, their entire life. They've never been to the Feast of San Gennaro. I'm the Grand Marshal. It's me and Jimmy invented invented a feast that goes on for 3 days where they close off streets
a
and shit.
A little bit hurt you pointing to yourself and going, I'm the Grand Marshal is a highlight for me.
Co-Grand Marshal. They've never been. They'll never be. I won the Pro Celebrity Long Beach race on last Saturday. Nope. My parents weren't there. Have no idea what it is. I've done it 3 times. They've never been there. They have no idea what it is.
Let me ask you this. Is there a comfort, as there is with me, in knowing that your parents won't see what you do? This podcast, for example, they'll never listen to it. That's why I speak so freely about them.
Listen, I like it. I don't know if you call it liberating. But no, so my mom, here's how my mom is wired.
Please.
And here's a very interesting thing. It's very sad but interesting.
No one's asked me a question.
She said, have you heard of this Jon Stewart? Because I find him hysterical. Oh. And I said, I know Jon Stewart, and I didn't want to be baited in because I've been sucked in before, and I'll tell you a story about that. I'm like, sucked in only to be pummeled.
We just have a cue.
And my mom said, my wife said, well, you know, actually Adam knows Jon Stewart. He's friends with Jon Stewart, and they have the same agent, James Baby Doll Dixon, and you know, he eats dinner with Jon Stewart. So yeah, Adam knows Jon Stewart very well. And
your wife said that.
My wife said it because I won't be sucked
into
it.
That's great. That's great.
My
wife, but this is a trap.
I've sucked in. And then my mom paused and said, he's a little bit hit and miss.
Wait, she changed.
Jon Stewart went from the funniest hot young comedian
to hit and miss.
To little hit and miss.
She wouldn't let you have it.
We would not. We never watched a videotape.
No.
Jon Stewart hosted the Oscars 2 years later. Name has never come up again. He is persona non grata in the Corolla. I actually talked to Jon Stewart and I said, buddy, I want to apologize to you because you had a couple of fans in the name of my mom and stepdad, and now you're dead to them. Because I made the mistake of saying I know you. And now, how good could you be? In other words, like Jon Stewart, how good could you be if my son is friends with you?
Yeah.
He went from, oh my God, have you heard of this guy? To
a mythic.
We don't need to watch the tape. Let's
he
see.
He went from a mythic to one of your knucklehead buddies. That's wrestling.
He went to one of my jack-off buddies.
He's a jack-off buddy.
In a second, just by me, and his name has never come up again.
Why would it?
And
I'm saying it should.
It should. Like the Oscars are held at the Kodak Theater. My mom lives 4 miles from the Kodak Theater. You fucking think she'd say, "Hey, your buddy Jon Stewart's hosting the Oscars. What about it? You think I get a ticket or something?" Like, name has never, ever been raised again. And I realized where this emanates from. Her mother. My grandmother died like 90. She died a few years ago, like 93.
Wow.
World-class ball buster. But she was the queen of this. Could not let any praise pass her lips for anyone in the family at any given time and pass this weird thing on to my mom. There's a great story where we were sitting around. We're eating Thai food for like my grandmother's 89th or 90th birthday, right? So now we're on year 5 or 6 of the aforementioned San Gennaro feast, and I've never said a word to my family because I'm not going to get burned. I'm not getting sucked in. I made a deal with them many years ago, a tacit agreement of I won't talk to you, you don't talk to me, I won't tell you about any failures or agonies or ecstasies, you don't tell me about your life, and we'll go through life.
So they don't even go your way. It seemed to reason
they have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know what they're doing.
It seems, though, that they would want to inform you about what they're doing.
They don't do anything. They go on walks.
Like
work with seniors. And, my mom's going to tell me about, you know, doing a senior aquatic class, where she jogged in place with floaties on her arms in the shallow end of a swimming pool. Like, there's not much going on. Let's be honest. So, and if I'm going to be on The Tonight Show, I will not tell anybody if I'm. There's no telling of anybody on anything.
I just want to relate. When I do a late night appearance, they don't watch, and like my friends don't understand that at all. But I don't know. That's just how it is.
Yeah,
that's normal to me. It doesn't make me sad in the least. I'll send my mom a link to Hulu the next day.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, she'll maybe figure
out. Now, why? Like, why don't you think, like, hey, fuck her, man. Why couldn't she stay up an extra 2 hours?
Well, because it's not 2 hours. They go to bed at, like, 6:30.
Oh, that's true.
I don't know. Because...
why are you sending them a link? Like...
I guess
my thing is like, fuck it. So we're sitting around a stable.
Yes, please.
This is the trifecta of Corollas. This is my sister, my mom, and my grandmother, and they all played their part. So we're sitting around Thai food joints about 5 years ago. Grandma's old but still alive. And my sister pipes up, and she does. My sister does a version. It's funny because my grandmother got the superpowers when it comes to, you know, making you feel bad about yourself, whereas my mom. She's the Aquaman, like she's limited but still pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And then my sister's kind of the Batman. She just has a utility belt, like she can't actually fly. But they still have their powers. And my sister does this one. She does her like, are you still doing that show on the comedy station?
That's
you
know, what your
like,
sister
like,
says?
Oh, yeah. Like, she doesn't know Comedy Central. You know, she'll say, like, and she'll do a lot of.
I thought that line would be attributed to the grandmother.
No. That's a compliment. She's asking about the show. She'll do things
that's
like.
That's a Corolla family
yeah,
compliment.
Oh, yes. That's as good as it gets.
A D minus.
That's Hallmark for Corolla. Like, she'll literally go.
The card is just a tranquil
scene. She's asking a question. Yeah. Like, she literally will go. And it's funny because you don't realize, like how insulting these questions are. She'll go, like, what channel is the comedy station on? Which one is that? And it's like, well, Man Show's been on for 4 years and Crank Anchor's been on 3 years, but I'm glad you don't know where to find it on your account. You know, so she'll do a lot of that. So my sister goes, I was at the store the other day and I saw a picture of you. It's just at the store standing by some cheese. And I said, what? And she said, yeah, there's a picture of you at the store. And I said, well, what was it? And she was like, I don't know. And it's like, first off, it's like, well, you didn't want to go walk over and investigate. Like, if I was going through the supermarket and I saw a cutout cardboard picture of you, sis, I would walk over and investigate. Wouldn't
yeah.
be like, hey, what is that?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm going to get some frozen lasagna and move on emotionally.
And you were on the lasagna, too.
Yeah. So she's like, what
I got the other one.
What was that? You know, she said, I don't know what that was. And I said, well, I don't know what it is either, because so far I'm just at a market. There's a picture of me at a market, you know? And I said, well, what was it? And she said, I don't know. And I said, but was it like behind the deli counter? Like, hey, dear Phil, nobody slices the beef as thin as you, my friend. And she said, no, this is like a advertising, like a cardboard cutout or something. And I said, well, what was it for? What product was it for? And maybe we'll know. And she said, I think it was cheese. You and Jimmy were on there for some cheese. And I said, I said, oh, precious cheese, me and Jimmy. Yeah, that's the Feast of San Gennaro. They're one of the sponsors of the Feast of San. That was a cardboard. That was an advertisement for them, cheese.
They make
mozzarella and for the Feast of San Gennaro. That's why me and Jimmy were on the picture.
Designed to make strangers look at it and retain information.
Right,
and you
right.
have family
My
members
sister had
who
no
can't
idea.
Be bothered.
Had to piece it together.
If
with
advertisers
their...
could figure out a way to like have an image that changes that becomes your family member... Like, if Coke could figure that
right,
out,
yeah.
when you look at it, you see your brother,
yeah.
sales would go through the roof.
Yeah.
Your family sees, actually, their brother can't be bothered.
Yeah, they're not secret shoppers. They're secret nappers. They just go into the store and tune out. And so I said, oh, and then she said, or somebody said, like, what's that? You know, and I said, now I got baited in.
Yeah,
I got
bait.
Sucked in. I got sucked in. And I said... well, the Feast of San Gennaro is actually a pretty big event. Like, we close off the street behind Jimmy's. It's 3 days. We sell thousands of tickets. They have bands playing and carnival rides. And everyone's kind of looking at me. And my grandmother realizes the clock
well
is
like,
ticking because I'm bragging.
Yeah,
I'm bragging.
Oh, okay.
I'm starting to brag. And I said... I said, actually, and this is where I got sucked in. I said, you know, actually, we have a scholarship set up, and we send kids to college, and we raise all kinds of money. And my grandmother just blurts from across the table, John Bon Jovi gave $1 million to Katrina Relief.
You just made my dick so soft.
And everybody just turned toward her and said, really? That is so generous. Oh. And then we talked about my 91-year-old grandmother. We talked about John Bon Jovi for the next 10 minutes.
Did you fill up with the hot tub of angst? Were you upset?
Oh, no. I was like, you know what? this one's my fault because I got sucked in. Like, I should have just said to my sister, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about with the Chiefs.
No,
certainly,
that sounds like surrender. Shouldn't we be working for a better family life?
It's my fault, and it's everyone's fault for not knowing who these people are. Like, all the young daughters trying to get love from that dad who'll never give it up to them. Move the fuck on. Fuck them. And don't be scared to go fuck them. And here's the decree. I will never be that way. I will not be that way with
my
children. Not be that way with my children. So what happened was, is we talked about John Bon Jovi for 20 minutes because, you know, she's writing the demo.
And his $1 million.
She's 91.
Yeah.
And we talked about Bon Jovi and what a generous cat he was for like 20 minutes. And then the following year, my mom said something like, well, you know, where are you going this weekend or something like that? And I said, well, I got to do the Feast of San Gennaro this weekend. And she said, Feast of San Gennaro? What's that? And I said, well, we talked about it last year. And she said, really? I don't remember talking about it. And I said, mission accomplished, Grandma.
Thank you. She's an assassin.
Now we're going on year 11 and no one's ever been there. No one in the family.
I have to think, Adam, I have to say, in my own family, I've seen little bits of progress through communication and stuff. I could help. I'm just saying, for your own sake, do you have fantasies of your sister understanding you a little bit better, you understanding her a little bit better?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. Wes is still with me. And
you betcha.
I wanted to talk in some detail about a series that, Wes, you've been doing on your podcast, Complete Liberty. You've been reading out of a book by Nathaniel Brandon called Breaking Free.
Mm-hmm. It was published in 1970, I believe, and it's out of print. Well, thanks to those publishers that Brandon signed up with. Quite a few of his books early on are out of print, but the questions that he poses to is basically, it's a book about his psychotherapy clients and group therapy, and each chapter is a story that happened in the therapy room in response to one of the questions that he would pose to the client about their childhood. And there's, I think, about 22 questions in total. And these are actually duplicated in another book that actually is in print, I think, called Honoring the Self. And in any event, you can get these things on Amazon. And he put those questions in there, too. So if you can't find Breaking Free, you can always get those in Honoring the Self, as well as in this podcast series.
Sure. And the idea is that in the adult self, there's that child that has often been traumatized in many ways still inside. And the solitary mind, with all of this stuff, the fear, the repression, can be a dangerous place. And one of the questions that the book sets out to answer through all of these other questions, one of the more general questions is, how was my psychological makeup essentially formed through these experiences and through my interpretations and conclusions from these experiences, correct?
Indeed. Yeah, it's basically what each person took away from their experiences in childhood, and how do they cope with those things? What sort of assessments of themselves and of other people and of reality in general did they draw or conclude from this?
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out, too, that the focus is really on the personal takeaway. One of the things that I was always concerned about, I try to stay on top of this and point this out whenever I think it's necessary, but one of the potential dangers I saw, some of the information that I was presenting on School Sucks, was I didn't want it to be misinterpreted as inviting a sense of victimization in people, or just encouraging them to blame someone else for their current situation. Now, these things are done to us, but they are done to us, and it becomes our responsibility to make meaning out of them, to understand what our conclusions were based on what happened to us, and to ask the all-important question, what can we do about it?
Indeed.
And I think Brandon does a good job from the parts of the book that I've heard you read, that it's not about assigning blame. It's about, like you said, evaluating the conclusions that you made from these experiences. I think that's a very, very important thing to point out, not just from this book, but in all of these topics about schooling or childhood parenting more generally.
Yeah. We live in a culture of moralistic judgment, so it seems somewhat easy to ascribe blame and shame and moralize the folks that introduced us to the world and treated us in a certain way. But it's kind of disempowering to take that stance as an adult, because our parents are 100% responsible for their behavior, and we're 100% responsible for our own behavior. And if we can pick up the pieces and put the puzzle together as to why we're doing what we're doing in the present based on the things that we learned from interacting with our parents early on, it can be empowering, you know, to basically turn into a new direction in our lives and find new strategies by which to get needs met that don't come at such cost. And this is kind of the things that these clients are grappling with. I mean, like one of the questions from the last episode was it your parents' practice to punish you or discipline you by striking or beating you? And this could fit under the category of spanking as well, right?
Yeah.
And I did a series on the book Unconditional Parenting, Moving from Rewards and Punishments to Love and Reason by Alfie Cohn. And within that category of punishment in general is love withdrawal and timeouts and a whole bunch of things that, you know, disciplinary methods that are used in place of spanking and are seen as somewhat useful or helpful or beneficial by many parenting experts, you know. And Cohn basically says, you know, we need to look at the general category of punishment, not just the spanking category.
Sure. You know, the first question in Breaking Free was really what hooked me. It went something like, did your parents' manner of behaving and of dealing with you give you the impression that the world was rational, predictable, intelligible, or a world that was bewildering, contradictory, incomprehensible, and unknowable? It really got me thinking about the broader historical context where children are born natural and rational into a world that has been, for many of the reasons that we talked about in our stolen concept discussion, the German idealism, the Immanuel Kant's, the reality is unknowable, into this world detached from reality and reason and sanity. And then they are taught to fit in. And if you think about the momentum that this has been able to pick up over time, the kind of free time that's needed or leisure time that's needed for introspection and self-evaluation and reflection is a relatively new phenomenon for most people. You know, like 100 years ago, almost nobody had that. The average person didn't have time to stop and think in a meaningful way. And, you know, there's all these inheritances generation after generation where this picks up to the present day. And, you know, the child, unaware or unexposed to any of that, is born into this world, like I said, rational, potentially rational and naturally, and then they're taught to fit into that. And that's it's a real shame. Like we were saying before, there's no one really to blame. It's just how it goes, you know, because nobody did. So few people have done that self-evaluation and that reflection on their own childhood experiences. That, as Brandon says in the book, this inheritance is just passed from generation to generation.
Yeah, as the sort of normal way to cope with things, to interact with self and others and to try to get needs met, basically.
Sure.
And yeah, it's a really tragic set of circumstances. And, you know, statism, of course, doesn't help matters at all, because it further degrades the prosperity in the economy and increases the standard of the cost of living and lowers the standard of living. And so people end up having to focus more on the day-to-day activities just to make ends meet. And they don't have a lot of time to reflect on things that the intellectuals are reflecting on, which is really determining the sort of outcome of our culture and keeping this conveyor belt of bad ideas going, you know?
Yeah.
Of incorrect ideas, of things that are not so helpful for people, but in general, but maybe helpful for a select few.
Well, from my own experiences, you know, I've worked with a lot of families over the past 6 or 7 years, two working parents, which is also a product of the same things that you're talking about, you know, one income, either the husband or wife's income, just not cutting it anymore. And both parents have to work. And so many kids are latchkey and they're turned over to daycare. I think that's in the same vein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is just, it begets more of itself. And a of course, the intrinsic motivation in kids is not fostered either by this set of circumstances, because, you know, kids are kind of put in these roles as student and as kid, as child, you know, to follow the commands or the demands of parents and educators. So, you know, when they're treated with the litany of carrots and sticks in their lives, they kind of lose their creative impulse and their inner drive to make sense of things and to think independently about this stuff and to critically question, examine the sort of ideas that they've been fed.
Sure. That leads in to the second question. Were you taught the importance of learning to think, the importance of developing your mind, the importance of becoming a rational being? Did your parents provide you with intellectual stimulation and the idea that the use of your mind can be an exciting pleasure? And school has a huge impact on a child in this respect. Granted, a lot of people don't even know what they're involved in doing, and they can't see the big picture of the impact, the negative impact that institutionalized schooling can have on a child. They're just kind of going through the motions, or they're on this conveyor belt that you describe. But that's something that I would say is really, in many cases, ignored. It's more about babysitting or managing or efficiency, but it's not about in any way, from anything I've seen as a student or a teacher, respect for the individual.
Yeah. And there can be lots of rationales for the present educational system. I'm sure if you did a survey of teachers, they would say that they want to inculcate in children their critical faculty and think independently and question things and stuff. But it seems to always skirt around the real issue, which is the context in which they're doing this, right? And they're more likely to grant an exception to the methodology being imposed on kids that's not critically questioning things and not challenging the so-called authority that's recognized as what's necessary for getting kids to do things for their own benefit, right? This is all for your own good, is what they say about the way the system works, right?
Yeah, I think that would ultimately lead, if that's said enough times and that's accepted and internalized by a young person, I think that could leave an imprint that would lead to a very confusing adult life. Like, why is everything that's for my own good suck?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't.
I like to do these things that are supposedly for my own good?
Yeah, and we always talk about on this show drawing the line, a very clear line. If you just want a simple way of categorizing things, voluntary and involuntary, there's a certain set of feelings and attitudes that are associated with activities that are voluntary, and there's a quite different set of feelings and attitudes that are associated with things that are involuntary. You know, they're opposites of each other. So if there's all these involuntary things that are for your own good, where does that lead? You know, I mean, I think nowhere but confusion. Life goes on.
Mm-hmm. Generates a society of conformity and obedience to so-called authority, right?
For your own good, yeah.
Yeah, and it really raises an interesting question about whether someone can actually get us to do anything that we don't want to do. How do they go about doing that? You know, the carrots and sticks, the pop behaviorism, as Alfie Kohn calls it, which comes from, you know, Skinner and Watson, operant conditioning theory, that this is how people get other people to do things. And it is really perverse because it gets us to act outside of our own inclinations, what we voluntarily would like to do.
Yeah,
just operating based on, okay, are we going to get a reward for this? Or are we going to get punished for this? You know?
Well, yeah.
And this is taking us outside of ourselves, and we're no longer independent, functioning, you know, volitional agents anymore, even though we always are. That's the trickery, right?
Yeah.
As Marshall Rosenberg, the founder of nonviolent communication, says, no one can ever get you to do anything you don't want to do. All they can do is make you wish you had. And then you can turn around and make them wish that they had not tried to do that.
Sure.
So these autonomy wars, you know, the battles of the will is what we end up with. The rebellion to these diktats, people trying to make us do things that we don't want to do.
Yeah, and the last fallacy that we covered prior to Stolen Concept was the appeal to fear and the appeal to force, which is kind of what is waiting. If it's not some, you know, positive reinforcement, the carrot, everything else at the end of it it is force or fear.
Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine a world where no one does anything they don't want to do. Some people immersed in the status quo would say, you know, society would grind to a halt. Of course you got to do things you don't want to do.
Well, I think that there, you might have to do things, smaller tasks within a larger goal that mm-hmm. are, like, I don't like filling out my Google Calendar every month.
Sure.
Right? So,
but
so
that's a means to an end that you want to do. Right?
That's desirable to me. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So if there's no end that is desirable, or it can't be understood by a young person, yeah, sure.
Yeah, having that thought in one's mind really allows you to reassess your priorities, doesn't it? To really think through, okay, what am I doing that I'm not really enjoying? And how can I go about optimizing what I'm doing so that I can spend more time doing what I really am passionate about and less time what I'm not so passionate about?
Yeah, and there might be, I don't want to use a word like sacrifices, but there might be things that are not, I would say, optimal uses of time. Considering the end goals that might be necessary. Like if I want to do something and say, I want to make this my job, or I want to make this my livelihood, I guess it would be a better way to say it. Well, how do I make ends meet in the meantime as I build this up to something that is sustainable or that can sustain me, right? Yeah, I think that makes sense. But still, yeah, part of a larger goal.
In the current paradigm, really, the rewards and punishments paradigm, the domination structure of education, that whole system, and the parenting paradigm of conditional parenting, you know, making everything contingent upon what the adult, the parent demands, that doesn't enable this process to really happen, does it?
No. And one of the interesting things in Breaking Free was this idea of reinforcing the negative self-concept, because of the punishment, the domination model of parenting. Brandon talks about young people growing into adulthood and sort of accepting this unearned guilt and then proceeding to earn it.
Yeah. Yeah. To do those very things. I mean, there's a lot of dynamics going on, obviously. There's the sort of less than thinking that I'm not worthy of happiness. And maybe I'll go about doing those behaviors that will ensure that, right? Or do those behaviors that I was punished for to prove that I actually am autonomous and I'm actually doing things that are detrimental to myself, but are in a rebellious sort of mindset towards what my parents demanded of me or punished me for.
Yeah.
It's like all this recapitulation of the trauma, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. The ages of these clients, I think, varied from early 20s to 40s, maybe.
Yeah.
Back in the 70s. But so, it's interesting because the themes are still consistent, right? You still see the same psychological patterns happening. People identify with these characters, with these clients.
There was this question of why aspire to be virtuous? There's nothing there to preserve. So just this reinforcement of the negative self-concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was sort of shown to the child. You'll never amount to anything. Or how about the dad that said, pick anything, I'll beat you at it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. You'll never be as good as me. And that was kind of a shocking form of, I don't know if we'd call it inferiority or superiority complex. But this whole one-upmanship, the win-lose paradigm of thinking that in order for me to be good or beneficial or to be happy, I have to be better than others.
Yeah.
To be worthy. Have to be better, beat them, you know, really tragic way of looking at human beings, that I have to sacrifice others to gain something, or I get sacrificed and they gain something, rather than looking at it, you know, human beings and society in a non-sacrificial way.
And when people in the book tell these stories and, you know, recount these specific events from childhood, I think a lot of people would, you know, look at these exercises and look at these experiences, these very difficult experiences for these people, and maybe ask the question, what's the point of feeling this? Brandon's response is, you know, that's a really dangerous question to even entertain, you know, of feeling these emotions. What's the point of that? The quote is, emotions are values, responses, summations, and reflections. When you turn off emotion, when you block emotion, it means to block the meaning. Right, to avoid the conclusion or to ignore the conclusion.
how you were assessing things right then and there. And if you buried that emotion, if you don't want to express it, you're burying that assessment of things. And it kind of comes back to bite us if we do that, because we close off a part of our world. That was a very important thing, an assessment that we drew, or a conclusion that we drew from that experience. And now as an adult, if we can heal that feeling, that experience, you know, looking at it through the adult mature lens to make sense of it at a time and place that we couldn't make a sense of fully as a child, you know, if we block all that off, then we don't grow, we don't heal, we don't move on.
That's the title line right there, basically breaking free, that there's these patterns of thinking, these patterns of behaving that were formulated through experience at a time where a person didn't have the knowledge or the perspective to evaluate it in a constructive way. Having none of those tools at that time, that just goes along into adulthood. And it seems like what the exercise is and the point of this, and what's the point of feeling this, is to return to that point. And he actually leads somebody in an exercise to kind of break them of this dissociation, I think is the word he uses.
Yes.
Where he says,
the guided imagery.
Let's take the tools that we have now, you know, as adults, and go back to those moments, replay them with greater knowledge and with perspective, and let's see what we can learn from it.
Yes. And then part of that process is granting validity or validation to those feelings, not dismissing them as invalid, you know?
Sure. Because
you're very angry at a parent, right? Very angry. And you get these injunctions from parents. Don't be angry, right? But if you are, you are. Your feelings can't be really disputed or refuted. They can just be honored and accepted or disowned and repudiated because of the fears that happen if one is angry at a parent. What does that mean, right?
Yeah. When the self is disowned, that childhood feeling of basically, I think one of the people in the book described it as, I was like a non-entity. Mm-hmm. And it carries it into adulthood, which in many ways, I would say, is responsible for a lot of the, you know, obedience and other kinds of, whether it's related to the state or not, self-sacrificial types of behavior, where
yes,
one kid is describing, or one of those clients is describing this experience that they had when they were a kid, saying, my parents used to talk about me right in front of me, as if I wasn't even there. And I mean, I remember that. I remember having that experience in school with teachers all the time. You know, it's like, you're talking to me in this chicken shit. I don't want to use that kind of language, but in a way that felt...
Bullshit?
No. I'm just saying, like, I don't want to...
Disparage, sort of, in a resentful way. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to be resentful about it, but maybe to use the words I have today, passive aggressive. Right? Because they're really talking to me. They want me to hear what they're saying.
Sure.
Like a specific example, if anyone is kind of uncertain about what I mean. But when I was in the first grade, I remember this because of what the ultimate outcome of it was. But there were these two teachers. They were like the fifth and sixth grade teachers. And the fifth and sixth grade classrooms were right across from the first grade and second grade classroom in the elementary school. And I was running around like a six-year-old, screaming, whatever, having a fun time. And these two teachers said to each other, that's Doug Vinat's kid. And my dad, who's Doug, was the chairman of the school board. And he had wacky ideas like teachers' pay should be merit-based, and they hated him, right?
Yeah.
So they said, oh, that explains a lot, right? Because I was being rambunctious and loud and kid-like, which I guess could be perceived by them as disrespectful.
You weren't being a, quote, good boy, right?
Exactly. So I hear this because they say it right in front of me, and I go home to my dad, and I say, Dad, at school today, two teachers said this. What does that mean? So there was, I think, some fallout for them at the next school board meeting as a result of that. But
they got a memo.
I think a lot of us might have that experience of being treated like, because we're a child, a non-entity.
Sure. And that relates directly to Brandon's articulation of the concept of psychological visibility.
Yeah.
And he's written about that extensively in various books, including The Psychology of Romantic Love, where it's kind of taken to its ultimate expression in a love partner. But I mean, that's a really important thing to, we have a need for visibility, to be seen, to be heard, to be understood, to be acknowledged, right? You know, parents and teachers sometimes disparage the notion of, you know, children seeking attention, right? It's kind of like it's a package deal there, but it's actually the need for acknowledgement, of understanding, of being seen and heard. And I mean, that's part of the need for being respected, being honored, you know, as an individual with your own feelings and needs and passions and aspirations, dreams, all that stuff, you know?
Well, I think what, unfortunately, the result of that kind of treatment would be is that very quickly, whether we're talking about at home or at school, a young person learns what needs to be repressed or hidden for one reason or another. And one of the clients, I think his name was Roger, talked about, you know, feeling no sense of effectiveness, no sense of importance. And Brandon goes on to say that, you know, it's these kinds of feelings. This is part of the reason why so few people can retain any, you know, can take into adulthood the ability to want anything passionately.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting things and struggling to achieve them is what life is all about, unquote. But I have no importance. I have no effectiveness. Why would I have passion about wanting something? Why would I deserve something? How could I get something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a friend who told me a story that's really heart-wrenching. He was wanting a toy when he was a little boy. And I think they were an atheistic family. They didn't recognize Christmas or anything like that. But it might have been, I don't know, just happenstance they were at a store. And his dad looked at him and said, "Ivan, you've never done anything to deserve a toy."
Mm.
Or, "What have you done to deserve a toy?" Something like that.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what the goal is. I mean, does a parent say something like that to be nasty or to vent frustration? Or do they think there's some kind of constructive goal for that kind of statement or treatment?
Yeah, maybe all of the above, huh? I imagine there is some stress and tension and frustration that gets projected out, right, onto the child. And then there's the idea that toys are for playing. What you need is discipline and hard work to get to become successful in a way that I wasn't successful, right? Because most parents will say they want their kids to become more successful and perhaps happier than they were, you know?
Yeah.
So there are those intentions as well. But I think the key thing to focus on, and what, you know, Brandon has kind of brought out too, along with Rosenberg and Alfie Cohn and so forth, is the needs of the child, to pay attention to those needs so that you don't, you know, damage the self-esteem and they end up in therapy years later, struggling to find out what they want and whether or not they deserve it, right? That whole deserve thing, you either deserve things or you don't deserve things. That that's part of the domination thinking as well. Somehow, you know, self-worth is conditional upon what you do or don't do, rather than you being, you know, worthy of happiness beyond the deserve paradigm.
Yeah. One of your quotes from
being accepted.
One of your quotes from one of your breaks when you were reading is, self-worth is a casualty of the domination culture.
For sure.
And this was right after the story of, I think his name was Tony, and he was a gambler.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that went with the story is, did your parents project that they believed in your basic goodness, or did they project that they saw you as evil, basically? And what he says, what Tony says, is, "I only felt important when being hit. My existence and importance were only ever acknowledged through punishment." You know, and I think this is certainly an experience that I had working in education, especially when I worked in this this boarding school for years. You know, at the time we probably had some like really inhumane and reductive slogan, like "the squeaky wheel gets the grease," but obviously an expression of some kind of need that isn't being met. That question is never asked by anyone, you know. And I think Brandon has the story where a mother takes her child to him.
Yes. The mother was concerned about the daughter's flights of fancy or something like that, that she snapped at her when she was trying to say that she was a wild stallion, or pretending to be a wild stallion. Yeah. And the mother's like, well, she's a female. She can't be a stallion. How stupid is that? She's just so stupid. She says stupid things, something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And Brandon said that I'm not ashamed to admit that I wanted to slap her face when she said something like that. But in a calm, collected way, he explained that this was a metaphor for her wanting to, you know, pursue her passions and realize her dreams and be more expressive and so forth.
Yeah.
And the mother just wasn't getting it, basically.
And it almost sounded like
she was still caught up in the domination paradigm, right?
Yeah. And it almost sounded like, from the way that Brandon was telling the story, that the mother brought the daughter to him so they could basically, like, the mother's goal was that they would gang up on her together, essentially. That she was looking for his approval of her condemnation of her.
For sure. Yeah. To fix this strange child, right? That's got all these impractical, unrealistic notions.
Now, that was in the 60s. Today, quite an industry has built up around that very idea. Kids being medicated, these like blanket diagnoses for, you know, five or six types of behavior. Where if you do this, this, and this, you need this Adderall.
Yeah. It's almost the age of diagnosis, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just astounding how disconnected that is from people's actual humanity and what's really alive in them. You know, rather than seeing the real person, they're seeing these manifestations of the domination paradigm that they're not willing to admit is a domination paradigm, but they see the manifestations as things to be fixed in order to get people to do things. To be good students, to be good citizens, to be good parents, you know?
Mm.
This role of being a good parent, of having a job description. I was listening to another talk at Libertopia by this gal, Rosalind Ross, who was talking about, you know, the philosophical side of parenting. And she had a diagram that explains the sort of control domination paradigm versus the freedom-oriented one. One is, you know, win, lose, and I have a job description. I'm a good parent, and I need to do these things in order to have a good child. And anything that gets in my way in this process, including the behavior of the child, must be punished and, you know, fixed. Versus the other thing, which is the freedom, independence, win-win solution orientation, where it's focused on the quality of the relationship between the adult and the child. Which is a whole different paradigm, isn't it?
Mm.
Imagine if teachers focused on the quality of the relationship between the teacher and the child or the student.
Yeah, and I think what it is about, and you know, unfortunately, this is very common in parenting too. Is the child a convenience or an inconvenience?
Mm-hmm. Right. Must their behavior be managed or empathetically understood, and therefore maybe the adult needs to change some things.
Sure. But right now, especially in the schools, it's being treated with all the humanity of like a, you know, a technical problem or a traffic jam.
Yeah.
You know?
Which explains like the barbed wire fences and all that stuff.
Yeah.
The lockdowns. I mean, it's very, very much like prisons, which are inherently inhumane. I mean, to say that the solution to the problem of someone not meeting your needs or not meeting their own needs or destroying property or something like that is to put them in a cage is really to admit that you really have no solution.
Sure.
It gets back to that final fallacy, right? The ad baculum.
Ad baculum. Force. Yep. The appeal to force. Yeah. All attempts at reasoning have ended and now we'll use violence.
Mm-hmm.
When do you think...
So how to break free from that paradigm, right?
Yeah, and that's more of a practical question here. This book obviously encourages, in addition to, you know, introspection as a starting point, the first pillar of self-esteem, to use Brandon's ordering of that, was living consciously.
Yes.
Right? Are you following a program that that you accepted, you know, uncritically, or are you following your own program to mm-hmm. understand that? And living consciously leads to acceptance, I think, which is the second, correct?
Yeah.
Second pillar of self-esteem. And
move into the self-assertiveness one, right?
Yeah. You know, acceptance is not surrender. Acceptance is not giving up. Acceptance is not saying, well, you know, everything is out of my control and I just have to tolerate a shitty situation. Acceptance with determination to change or to make a change is empowering.
Understanding where you are in order to get where you want to be.
Sure. And I think that certainly leads to the third one, which is self-assertiveness, correct?
Mm-hmm. Not sitting on your needs, being a zealous advocate for getting needs met. Right. In a win-win fashion. That's the key, right?
Yeah.
Finding strategies that are win-win, so which acknowledges other people's similar path in life. They're on the same path. One of the things I've found really heartfelt from Joe Rogan when he talks on his show is he says, you know, what we need is a world where people see other people that are strangers as just them in a different set of circumstances. So that's kind of the psychological visibility, right?
Yeah.
And treating other people as equals and acknowledging that, you know, that could be you if you had lived in those same sort of circumstances and were thinking those same thoughts and doing those things. So there's not these huge, you know, irreconcilable gaps between people because we all have the same needs. Gets back to that. And of course, you know, the other three pillars to the six pillars is responsibility, integrity, and living purposefully.
And as far as the introspection and the work and really focusing more, I think, on the first two of the pillars is called for in many ways in Breaking Free. And Brandon has other useful workbooks. The Sentence STEM book was, what was the title of that?
The Art of Self-Discovery.
The Art of Self-Discovery.
Yeah.
I think that these are often projects that people begin in desperate situations, psychologically, emotionally, as adults. Do you think someone could start doing this? Do you think it would be safe to start doing this when somebody was like still in school, still a teenager?
I think so. I mean, a lot of people read Ayn Rand's books when they're teenagers. I think Nathaniel read The Fountainhead when he was 14, 13 or 14, I think it was. And he read it over and over again. I guess he could quote, you could say any sentence in The Fountainhead. He said this in some tapes I have. And he could quote the sentence preceding it and the sentence following it.
Wow.
That's how much he had integrated that novel.
It's not Atlas Shrugged, but it's not a small book.
No, it's about 800 pages, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
About hard work and being an independent person amidst a culture that's demanding human sacrifice and thinking in a collectivistic way.
Right.
So, yeah, I think the teenagers are definitely where one is forming one's identity, trying to make sense of things. And yeah, the sky's the limit there. And going into these recesses of our mind, these subconscious areas where, you know, it's a bit scary, it's a bit disturbing, but if you have the motivation, it can be extremely fulfilling because you're basically getting a map of yourself. You're getting an understanding of who you are and how you came to this place psychologically, emotionally. And coming to the conclusion, as you do these STEMs, the Art of Self-Discovery is really comprehensive, but you come to the conclusion that you are your own best friend in this process. So there's, you know, various facets of your mind. And brain researchers talk about, you know, the many minds model. We all have these minds competing with each other within our own head because it's a very parallel processor we have here. But to understand yourself from these different perspectives in your life, you know, when you're a child, when you're a teenager, he does have a lot of exercises about the teenage self. So that would be somewhat superfluous, I guess, if you're a teenager doing those, because it's really for the person who's in adulthood, young adulthood, reflecting back. But it's all helpful stuff. I mean, it's all about self-empathy, self-compassion, self-acceptance, all those things.
Yeah.
Coming to terms with yourself in a way that people never really did when you were a child, you know, to honor yourself, to see yourself as a completely worthy being, regardless of what you do and say, so that you can do things that are in benefit to yourself, to your own self, and to not do it in a sacrificial way, sacrificing others in the process, you know?
Yeah. And that being said, I would think the sooner you could start, the better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess we're susceptible to emotionally traumatic events all throughout our lives. But, you know, from my own experience, I remember some pretty significant negative imprints all through high school, you know, still at a time when, because of everything that preceded it, I was really impressionable to that kind of stuff, really internalized a lot of it. And one of the biggest challenges for me as a young adult was learning that I wasn't stupid. 'Cause I was convinced, you know, like really through my... I almost called it my educational experience, but that hadn't even started yet. My schooling experience, I'm interested to discover, to look at it closer and see how much family life had to do with that. But I know that school had a really significant and negative impact on me as far as, you know, self-esteem. And I'm not talking about school as the villain. I'm talking about, you know, my conclusions based on my experiences.
Yeah, it's a context.
Yeah, which is something that we have to take responsibility for. So not let's not do school as the villain, but the conclusions that I came to that impacted negatively self-confidence, self-esteem, what does Brandon call it? Self-concept generally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because self-esteem is seen as the evaluative aspect of self-concept.
That was something that continued for me through high school. And
sure.
You know,
I mean, the whole grades and test paradigm is based on this pecking order of intelligence, isn't it? I mean, when you get that thing back and it says a C on it or a D, I mean, if you really want to get through the system, you've got to determine, is this a mark on my intelligence or not? I mean, a lot of people just check out and say, this is a bunch of bullshit, which is one way to do it, obviously. And each way has its consequences. And I really feel for the kids that are having to go to school and see through the matrix, see the bullshit aspects of it, and just for sure survival need to go through it, you know?
Yeah.
Parents that can't afford to pay to unschool or to go to a private school that's like a Sudbury model that respects their own choices, you know?
It's also worth acknowledging here, as we've done on the show before, how tangled this web actually is. And when you step out of the more emotional part of this into the, well, you know, the grammar, the language, and the logic of it, and when you talk about people saying this is bullshit and checking out, another thing that Brandon talks about in the book, that kind of going on strike emotionally. Mm-hmm. One of the things that tragically a lot of people take with them is they think their schooling was education. They think that schooling was synonymous with enlightenment.
And those would be the A students, right? The honor roll people.
Well, they think they're synonyms. They think schooling, the institutionalized schooling experience and education or knowledge acquisition is the same thing. So a lot of people that I've encountered in the adult world, and you know, maybe listeners can identify, are somewhat proud or at least satisfied with their, you know, admitted ignorance of the world around them. We see people gleefully cheering a future of less security, of less prosperity, potentially, for their own children. You know, just because they're happy with a very superficial, shallow knowledge of, you know, left versus right politics or economics or any of these things that could have a very significant impact, you know, maybe not on their lives, but on the lives of their children. And they settle for this this intellectual apathy instead. And they're proud of it.
Yeah, it's a really tragic set of circumstances. And I really like the ending that Brandon had in his book, Honoring the Self. I could say that this book is addressed to my colleagues, that I might share with them observations that would prove useful in their own work. I could say that the book is addressed to anyone in any profession who is interested in the great issues of psychology and ethics. But these statements are true but limited. Both these statements are true but limited. It is to anyone who loves his or her life and has not known that there is no higher virtue that this book is addressed. To anyone struggling for personal happiness while being told that personal happiness is the concern of the spiritually inferior. To anyone who understands that ego and self are a height to be climbed, not an abyss to be escaped. To anyone who does not see freedom as a burden, or choice and responsibility as a tragedy. To anyone who appreciates the courage and integrity that honest selfishness requires. To anyone who grasps that without self-assertion, no dignity is possible. To anyone fighting for self-esteem against an onslaught that begins in the nursery and extends to the Himalayas. To anyone able to see that this earth is the distant star we must find a way to reach, it is for you that this book is written, in your defense, in your honor. Nathaniel Brandon, 1985. Yeah, I read that simultaneous with Atlas Shrugged back in my early 20s when I graduated from college. Very, very eye-opening, transformative. And I would say my interaction with Rosenberg's work, Marshall Rosenberg, a couple of years ago, Nonviolent Communication, has been equally transformative because it enables one to step outside of the moralistic judgment domination paradigm into a realm where we're focused on what's alive in us and how we can go about meeting needs in a way that is non-sacrificial.
And we did a couple of shows on my podcast about nonviolent communication, but you have a whole series about it on Complete Liberty.
Yeah, it starts with episode 126.
Yep. And Daniel Lockmacher and I participated, I believe, in a couple of those episodes. And I encourage people to go check that out and check out Rosenberg's work as well. And you actually sent me something that was a very useful and a very non-intimidating way to learn a lot about this in a short amount of time. Do you have a link to that that I can put in the show notes?
I do, yes. I actually uploaded it to my server at happinesscounseling.com. So
I'll link to it there.
It's at happinesscounseling.com/NBC and then _intro.pdf.
Yeah, it's about 9 pages, right?
Mm-hmm. Actually, 14.
14.
Yeah. It's put together by this business group, I think. But yeah, I thought it was really succinct and covered all the aspects that could bring one up to speed with it. Talking in a way that doesn't involve moralistic judgment. It's a task, I tell you. And sometimes we're not in the mood for that. But it falls back on the notion that we are most likely to get our needs met when we communicate in a compassionate way with ourselves and with other people.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I said, this is useful in life. It's very hard to be producing some kind of media, you know, which has as one of its purposes entertainment, to not be able to put the jackal puppet on and just go to town, you know. So, but the problem with that is if you spend too much time doing that, you know, even as an adult, that kind of thinking, that kind of, as I you know, said a bunch of times in the past, you know, our words become our thoughts a lot of the time. And, you know, if you spend a lot of time talking like that or engaging in confrontational discussions with other people who use that language and try to put everything into that win-lose paradigm, it can be very unproductive. At the very least, you know, I've walked away from a lot of more confrontational discussions feeling very bad, feeling very unsatisfied, feeling very unproductive, right? So we do things because we are trying to fulfill some kind of need. For years, I engaged in that kind of dialogue with people and met no needs, you know? Never walked away from a conversation.
Get much things solved either, huh?
Never solved anything. My dad did say to me once, "You can't tell how much you've changed, how much everyone else thinks, but you have." And he said, "I don't think you can see it because basically you're so far away from where everyone else
you're
is.
The bleeding edge,
that,
right?
Yeah, you're so far away from where everyone else is that you can't see the baby steps that they took, but everybody moved, sure. You know?
And all the heel marks right in the dirt. Big tug of war, right?
Exactly. But I don't feel like for the amount of time and thought and stress that was poured into those interactions that they were, you know, the cost-benefit analysis of them is not, it doesn't look like they were productive. And I don't walk away from those kind of interactions feeling like something was accomplished, feeling like some kind of need was met. I think a lot of that has to do with the thinking and then subsequently the language that goes into those discussions and how they're all being framed, maybe for the participants, myself included, by you know, a media that is entirely about the jackal language, the domination culture. And when you're put into that box and you have to use their words and their phrases, yeah, it's disempowering, it's unproductive, it doesn't meet any kind of need for, you know, mutual understanding or clarity, productive, meaningful communication, none of that. Because that's not the point, you know? It seems like the media are about mass confusion and anger as entertainment.
Sure.
I found it very helpful for me to spend less time. I used to a show prep, watch the news, listen to the radio, scroll up and down the news feed on Facebook. There's not a lot of positivity there, you know, and I felt like by not paying attention to the impact that that can have, the impact of that is very negative. You know, by not acknowledging what that is imprinting slowly you know, chipping away at you day by day.
And, you know, as far as the language goes, we have a whole culture of, you know, put down humor too, like in sitcoms and stuff. And that tends to be quite caustic on the soul, if you will, within the paradigm that we live in. I mean, if you listen to like Joe Rogan talk to his guests, he doesn't really put them down ever. And yet he uses a, you know, sometimes a harsh dialect of Jackal, but you can see, you know, that there's some life enriching stuff being presented, you know?
Sure.
And he calls his audience a bunch of dirty bitches. He's doing it in a loving way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's lots of room and leeway for humor and expression and stuff, as long as you're seeing the needs beneath the expressions, you know?
Yeah, and I think comedy should be about taking risks. And comedy,
irony, right?
Yeah, and I think comedy should be. Some of the comedy that I enjoy really pushes the limit, you know?
Stanhope and Louis C.K.?
Yeah, some of the podcasts that I listen to. I think there should be a risk in comedy. I think that makes it entertaining. But I also think if you're off guard, that stuff can be, what was your expression? Caustic for the soul?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I remember one day when I was feeling down, I said, you know what I need is some comedy. So I started watching this show called How I Met Your Mother.
Fox News?
No. Oh. How I Met Your Mother.
How I Met Your Mother.
Have you ever seen that?
No.
Well, it's Neil Patrick Harris, who I love, who's great.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, this group of friends, like 30 somethings, a couple of them are roommates and basically just their lives together. They mm-hmm. treat each other like shit. And like all the humor in the show is them doing something mean at like the other person's expense.
And but they're making a movie.
What's this is not making me feel better at all, this show, How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah.
Because everything is, it's like they're a bunch of psychopaths.
Uh-huh.
Just like hurting each other for the amusement of the studio audience and themselves.
Lord of the Flies, except they're not on the island.
Not quite at that level. But it's, you know, people calling each other friends and not treating each other very well was my, you know, I watched maybe, ultimately watched about a season of the show. And this is kind of like being on guard for stuff like that. So it doesn't wind up poisoning the soul, for lack of a better expression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just watching it, not really cognizant of how it was making me feel. But like, this show doesn't make me, like, if I, you know, I want to laugh and feel good. Like, why am I laughing at this? And some of it is, you know, funny. But yeah, the show just very negative.
What was that one with Harris in it? That do you have a bit part in that or what? The Harold and Kumar go to White Castle? Is mm-hmm. that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a very clever role because he's a child star, right? He was Doogie Howser, I think, when he was like 15 years old. So what happens to child stars? Well, drugs, jail, and True Hollywood Stories. So
yeah,
Neil Patrick
usually doesn't end well.
Yeah, and Neil Patrick Harris is a guy who had that stardom as a child and went on to, you know, like do Broadway plays and be successful as an adult. So this role that he's playing in that movie where he gets in the car and he's like on acid or something hitchhiking.
Exactly.
it's pretty ironic. It's funny. All right, so everybody who is listening, thank you so much for your participation. This chat is fantastic. I really
thanks a lot. It's cool stuff.
Yeah, I really like when people get involved, and I think there's a kind of scrolling through it right now. It looks like there's a couple of decent side conversations happening, which is great. And we will be back next Thursday at 10. We'll be on LRN. They say, thank you guys. Awesome show. Two different people say that. So you are welcome, and thank you for participating. All right. Good night.
Good night.
As a child, I was utterly devastated and just constantly bummed out by how depressed my mom was and how depressed my dad was, and how, you know, there's an element of people going, oh, did you blame yourself for their depression? Not really. It's just they were bummed out all the time, and that sucked for me.
Yeah.
I never saw my mom laugh. I never saw her smile. Oh, I never saw her have a good moment.
Your childhood isn't black and white in my mind.
They did not have teams they cheered for. I never saw my mom dance. I never saw her like just go, fuck yeah, and jump up when someone scored a touchdown or anything. She was bummed out her entire life. She cannot enjoy. She cannot do anything. And they're totally They're both the two least physical people I've ever met in my life. Mm-hmm. They don't hug. They don't. There's no. I never wrestled with my dad. We never hug. We never. Everything's weird. So I wanted to first and foremost be physical with my kids. Like, I wrestle with my kids.
Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to let them know, and this is, you know, we talk about all the time in this society, like, you know, we never stop talking about have your kid belted into a properly, you know, it's a safety seat. You know, it's all fucking talk about safety seats and seat belts and clicked in and secondhand smoke. Let me tell you something. Secondhand smoke, fucking who gives a shit about secondhand smoke? You know what the PSA should be about? Don't bum out your kids. Fucking have a dance party once a week with your kids.
Yeah.
Hug them. Wrestle them with them. Yeah. Be silly in front of your kids.
Yeah.
Be crazy. I do crazy dance parties with my kids.
No, I think you're right. That's a real illness, too. Not being silly and not being fun and not having a childish environment.
I want my kids. Here's what you want. You know, as there's all this thing where it's like, you know, you want them to be able to speak a second language. It's important that they learn, you know, turn on this part of their brain, which is going to help later on when they're exposed to this and they're exposed to that. And all this fucking shit you want to expose them to. Half the shit is what you want to expose them to, and then the other half shit is what you don't want to expose them to, like radon or unfiltered water or secondhand smoke or inorganic eggs or whatever the fuck it is. None of that stuff means shit. They could drink from a fucking hose their whole life. They'll be fucking fine while a guy stood next to them and smoked. They would be fine, but I'll tell you where they won't be fine. If they think mommy and daddy aren't enjoying life, not enjoying not only them, but life.
Yeah.
I want my kids to know not only is dad digging it, like I'm driving my race cars, I'm doing my thing, yep. I'm enjoying myself, number one. And number two, I'm enjoying you.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying my kids. I had a moment last week where after I won the Celebrity Toyota Grand Prix of Long Beach, I just reached over. I was in my fire suit and a whole nine yards. And I reached. That's a suit you wear when you're.
Okay, I got it.
I thought you
I wear a fire suit when I dance with the ponies. Some of the ponies fire breathe.
I like reached over the string with the paparazzi and everyone was celebrating the champagne and everything, and I fucking picked my kid up. I picked my son up and I just grabbed him and was just hugging him, and he was just sucking it all in, and people are like cheering, and he'll remember it forever.
Yeah.
And I want him to know that dad is having a good time.
Yeah.
Dad is digging it. Well, this part of the reason dad's digging his life is because of you two.
Right.
See, he dug his life before, and now he digs it even more that you guys are here.